This is PCJ Radio International. The Happy Station Show, produced and presented by Keith Pehon.
And welcome again to another edition of Happy Station from PCJ Radio International. Well, we didn't begin with our usual sing tune this week. Instead, we began with I Want You to Meet My Baby, sung by Edie Gourmet. The reason is, after last week's program, we discovered that Edie Gourmet passed away last week at age 84. Today's show is a tribute to Edie Gourmet and her husband, Steve. In 2010, I interviewed Steve Lawrence from his office in Las Vegas. And it just gives an insight to this married couple who are well known as being one of Hollywood's most famous happy married couples. So, in tribute to Edie Gourmet and her husband Steve Lawrence, we pay tribute to this fantastic popular standard singer.
I was at a dance when he caught my eye, standing all alone, looking sad and shy. We began to dance, swaying to and fro, and soon I knew I'd never let him go. Blame it on the bossa nova when it's magic spell. Now I'm glad to say I'm his bride-to-be, and we're gonna raise a family. And when our kids ask how it came about, I'm gonna say to them without a doubt, blame it on the bossa nova with its magic spell. Blame it
have you been able to maintain your voice for so long? Because so many singers, except for a few exceptions, maybe like Mel Torme and a few others, have been able to maintain their voice in such good condition.
Well, first of all, let me say that you're right. I have never been asked that question, especially as a leadoff question. But to truthfully answer that, I really wouldn't know where to begin. I guess maybe genetics might be a piece of that. I don't smoke to speak of, and I don't drink in excess. I drink socially, and I don't abuse my voice. Maybe that has something to do with it, and I think my dad was a cantor. I don't know if you know what that is, but he did a lot of cantorial religious singing, and I grew up as a choir boy.
Mm-hmm.
So this came to me kind of quite naturally, and the outgrowth was like, as opposed to an old movie that Al Jolson made called The Jazz Singer, I went into the world of popular music after I heard my first Frank Sinatra record when I was about 13, 15 years old or whatever, you know. So I just thought, this is what I want to do with the rest of my life. But and it's a funny thing about liturgic music, you know, like when it has no respect for octaves or range. You know, you could go from the bottom end of your vocal abilities to the top end and stretch it. So that probably was some great training for me as well, because it's not as regimented and not as organized in a sense as pop music is. You know, popular music, there's a beginning, a middle, and an end, and usually it's eight bars, and then the next eight bars are repeated, and then there's a bridge which separates it musically and lyrically from the rest of it, and then they come back and repeat it. So there's a form to pop music, but in religious singing and training, they couldn't care less about eight bars now and later. You know, you're at one end to the other, you know. Edie had a similar training too, but she had a natural gift. And I think maybe a piece of that, if I could throw that in, that might be a little bit of a natural gift as well. On top of the fact that I really never really abused it. So, that's the only way I really can possibly think of answering that, you know.
At any point, because I know that you, you know, a lot of people would not know your Jewish name, and I think a lot of people wouldn't be able to pronounce it. But when you were singing in a choir and your father being a cantor, was there ever any pressure on you to maybe even go into that direction?
Not in the slightest. It was never discussed, and I guess maybe he probably assumed on his part, although, as I said, we never talked about it, he probably thought that I would, since I was doing that as a choir boy, I might just extend it and go into that. But when I first started to show signs of being influenced and wanting to go for and being very affected by the world of the American popular songbook, he just said, you know, do what you like, son. He said, you know, just go wherever your heart takes you, because music is, all kinds of music is wonderful, and you'll be a very happy camper, not cantor. You'll be a very happy camper with that in mind, because music is just love from the soul, and it's just do whatever it is you want to do. Just make sure it's something you're happy to get up and go to work and do.
When you said just a moment ago that when you heard your first Frank Sinatra record, which had influenced you, What was it like for you, you know, many years later, being able to perform with him and be on stage? Did Frank look at you as being like a son, like, you know, the younger guy who's come along?
Probably, but we never talked about it. I think he always looked at me as the up and coming generation behind him. But I must say, he really was like a beacon for all of us who came after him in the world of popular music. And all of us, we would not be truthful if we didn't say that he had some influence on all of us who came after him, because not that you did an impression of him or tried to sound like him, but his approach to a pop song became more of like a screenplay.
Mm-hmm.
You know, there was a beginning, a middle, and an end, and he was the first to pay attention to the lyric content, more importantly than up until then, you know, they were singing like, hey, it had to be you, it had to be you, I wanted, and he took that and meant it had to be you. You know, he made it, he could be singing to thousands of people, but everybody thought that he was just singing to that one person.
Mm-hmm.
And that's a great ability that he had. so that he took that, and he was primarily a great storyteller, and that bled over very easily for him into his acting career. I mean, Frank made 60 or more films through his career. Most of them were pretty darn good. There was a couple he'd like to take back, I'm sure, as we all have done professionally in film or on records. You know, you hear records that you made years ago, you say, why in the world did I record that? But at the time, it seemed like a good idea, you know. But and also, the record business was different in those days. I don't know if you recall what the A&R meant, Keith, but that meant it stood for Artist and Repertoire. And every record company had an A&R division. So when you were getting a record, they would garner a lot of material out there from writers and publishers, and you all had mutual agreements. So, and in those days, we recorded live with the orchestra in the studio, and you would do 4 songs on a 3-hour record date. So, you know, that was today. Today they go in and they spend 6 months on one song. You know, they have the technology today is such where they can literally record one instrument or just add one note or take it out, and they spend you know, they advertise the fact, my first studio album in 12 years, like it's a big deal. You know, those of us who grew up in that time when you had to finish an album in 3 days of recording, so it was different, you know. It also, I think, it put a gun to your head, and there's something about having a deadline. Mm-hmm. George Burns, I'm sure you've heard of George Burns, but he put it probably best. You know, they kept asking him how long he's going to keep performing. He says, hey, and he was like 97 at the time. He says, well, I have to open at Caesar's Palace in 2 months. He says, everybody should have an opening. You know, you can't just rehearse the rest of your life. You have to have an opening night, an opening day, whatever. So, you know, over the years, I've had the good fortune of getting to meet a lot of people I grew up tremendously admiring. And years later, when Frank and I became really friends and got to call each other by first names, and I would sit down and, you know, just have a lunch with him or have a drink with him, or Edie and I had a beach house out in Malibu, California, and he wanted to rent. We had the same manager, so he knew we were working all summer, so he wanted to rent my house for the summer. I said, well, you can't rent my house. You could stay there. You and Barbara could stay. He says, no, kid, I want to rent your house. I said, you cannot rent my house. He says, I said, no, you want to stay there? Please, my pleasure. So we went back and forth. He stayed there, but he's an extraordinarily generous and gracious man. He bought my kid a gift. I wouldn't even begin to tell you. I mean, he really is a very special man and unique in many ways. I had the pleasure of, I heard for years, I heard that he had a dark side. I fortunately was never exposed to that. So I only knew him from the wonderful contribution that he made to the world of popular music and to films, and the influence that he had on all of us younger kids who came after him. And you know, and I used to play cards with him on Sunday. I must tell you, growing up in the shadows of this musical giant, then becoming his friend, and then sitting at a poker table with Frank Sinatra and Gregory Peck and Kirk Douglas and Jack Lemmon, I mean, I'm looking at these people, and it dawned on me that I was the only one at the table I never heard of. it was incredible that I'm sitting with these idols of mine, and we have become friends. And that, to me, meant a great deal, that you're on a first-name basis, you could tell each other whatever you felt like, and your tastes and your wants and needs ran along the same lines, and it was really a wonderful time. Unfortunately, I think a lot of that camaraderie is no longer exists in the business today. I find that everybody is so much by themselves and into their own world, and probably maybe that's why they're getting into a lot of trouble too, these kids. I don't know.
Now let's take a listen to Steve Lawrence from his latest CD. Steve Lawrence sings Sinatra with My Kind of Town on the International Happy Station.
My kind of town. Chicago is my kind of town. Chicago is my kind of people too. People who just smile at you. And each time I roam, Chicago is, it's calling me home. Chicago is one town that'll never ever let you down. It's my kind of town. My kind of town, Chicago is. It's my kind of town. Chicago is my kind of razzmatazz. And it has all that jazz. And each time I leave, it's tugging my sleeve. Chicago is the Wrigley Building. Chicago is the Sox and Cubbies. Chicago is one town that'll never ever let you down. It's my town. Chicago, 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 Chicago. Yeah, Chicago.
You know, like all the rumors about Frank, I mean, my feeling has always been, you know, like, he was extremely famous and people love to gossip and just say all kinds of gobbledygook, and half of it I don't believe anyway, because other musicians that I spoke to, including recently Johnny Mann of the Johnny Mann Singers, who had worked with Frank on a couple of sessions, we talked about this, and he said, oh, a lot of it is just gobbledygook because people are jealous, you know.
But he was an easy target, you know. You know, you say Frank Sinatra, and you say something derogatory about him, and people are listening like you knew what you were talking about.
Yeah.
But, you know, if he did say something derogatory about someone, I'm sure he had a reason for it.
Yeah.
But as I said, I never was exposed to that, because we always had good times and good fun, and we traveled the world with him for a year. Edie and I went literally to around the globe with him, and no matter where in the world we were, he was Frank Sinatra. In Italy, they knew him from his records and his. In Japan, they couldn't speak English, but they came there with his albums. They were singing the songs with him. I've got you under my skin, yeah, Frank. You know, boom, boom, boom. And then they come backstage and say, "Oh, they got the Frank Sinatra." It was incredible that they knew him professionally, internally, and externally. He was really. He sang for six generations.
Mm-hmm.
You know, so he had children, their mothers, their grandmothers, their great-grandmothers. I mean, it was, I can't think of anybody else that went through that professionally and gracefully and made the contribution that he has on many levels. And it's just, I was just happy to have him as a friend and as a mentor. I just was really very fond of him. I always made him laugh, which killed me. Because he just loved laughing and jokes and things like that. He couldn't tell a joke to save himself, but he loved hearing it. You know. But he had a good sense of humor. I mean, he would see things funnily, but he just couldn't say, you know, these two guys got off a streetcar. And he just couldn't tell he couldn't tell a joke. You know, but he really had a good sense of humor and loved good times, and he was bigger than life. I mean, you know, we'll never see the likes of him again. But fortunately for us and for generations to come, he leaves behind the greatest legacy in American popular music. Mm-hmm. He's just a very special guy on a lot of different levels.
Let's talk about the music industry for a change, you know, for a moment, because you were talking about, you know, the A&R man, and I've interviewed a number of people about this, and they said it was the kind of thing where they would get a call from the record company saying, we have this song, we want you to do it. During that period, it was the A&R men and the producers and all the suits and executives that really had a lot of say over what the artist was recording. At any point when you were recording stuff, maybe like Party Doll, did you just go and think to yourself, what are these people doing?
Very often, as a matter of fact. That's why I think the word came into being in, and was signed in, and was put into contracts, where the material, they said it was mutual agreement. So since you were doing four sides, you could object to two. And two, or you know, do two. The company said, this is going to be a hit, do it. And, well, I like these two songs, so you would do the two songs that you brought to the table. And they brought two songs to the table. Sometimes they were pretty good, and sometimes they were not. But you had to do what was called mutual agreement. And in some cases, the song may have gotten great recognition, become a turntable hit, or even sold well. But it was something that you just, you know, you were not too thrilled about. You know, if you had your druthers, you probably would not have done it. But, you know, somebody always comes up and says, hey, I love that song you did, and they name a song that you try to hide. You know, you say, no, that wasn't me. That was somebody else.
Yeah, I you know, not too long ago, I interviewed Miss Shirley Bassey, and she said that when she first initially recorded Goldfinger, she hated the song.
Yes,
It made her cringe, but she said now it's become so identifiable with her that she says she still sings it, but she says she remembers that I still hate the song.
She was quite a dame, boy. She really was. She still is. I mean, God love Goldfinger. She was bigger than life too. She really was, and a great artist, a great performer, by the way.
So, you know, getting back to that, I mean, when you and Edie first recorded This Could Be the Start of Something Big, which was composed by Steve Lawrence, and people... Steve Allen. You know, Steve Allen was not just great on television, but he was also a very good composer and wrote some very wonderful songs. Of course, this is the song that is most identifiable with him. How did this song come about? Did he say, you know, I'd like you to do this on the show? And then the record company said, oh, we want to release it as a single?
Steve was extraordinarily talented on many levels. First of all, he was one of the brightest people you'd ever want to sit in a room and talk to. And he was a wit, funny as heck. And he was an author. He wrote something like 52 books. Some were novels and some were stories. And I learned so much from him, because in the early years of The Tonight Show, Steve created what became The Tonight Show in America. And he that whole format of behind the desk and then having people sit and interview and talk and get up and perform. And the only difference was that he had a steady group of players on the show. Namely, we had an orchestra that was always there. We had 5-6 musicians originally, but then when they got to the network, they expanded the band. But Edie and I were the boy and girl singer where we met on that show. And so I have a great deal to be thankful for him, to him. And he had a show on, I don't know if you ever saw it or not, but Keith, there was a show in this country called Meeting of the Minds. Mm-hmm. I don't know if you ever saw that. It was on public broadcasting here. And what he did with that was extraordinary. And he would take people from history. It was like a talk show. But he would take, Thomas Jefferson. He'd have an actor portraying Thomas Jefferson, another guy playing Julius Caesar, another guy portraying Jesus Christ, another guy playing Thomas Albert Edison. And he did tremendous research on how they felt about things, and he put it in today's milieu, except they were dressed in character. And it was a talk show around a table. And they were talking about whatever it was, the economy, or how they felt about the certain political situations, or the world, or religion. And here, based upon the writings of, let's say, Thomas Jefferson, how he felt about it, the actor would express, Steve wrote out what his expression was on that. It was such a brilliant idea that nobody could stop watching it, but it was on public broadcasting and didn't really generate a big audience on that. But I always thought it was terrific.
So when you did that song for the first time...
By the way, he wrote that song, This Could Be the Start of Something Big, as not only for me and Edie to do on the show, but he also he used to use it a lot as one of the themes of his show. So, and it became so identified with us, with the record and all, that that was like the first big record that we had together. You know, This Could Be the Start of Something Big, and it really was. And I will forever be grateful to him for all the experience that Edie and I individually and collectively garnered on that show. The last thing we were called upon to do was sing. He threw us into sketches, or they were hitting us with pies, putting us in oven. I mean, it was nuts. We were sitting, standing on top of the RCA building, singing, or under a swimming pool, or jumping. We did remotes from different parts of the country live. At that point, it was unheard of. And the director, Dwight Hemian, was the first guy to use that blue psych. So I was doing once a song called "Smoke Gets in Your Eyes," and in front of a blue psych. And he had me shrunk down to the size of a cigarette, and I was singing it on top of an ashtray. it was nuts. And also, he was very picture conscious. Dwight was probably one of the best directors I've ever worked with in my life. And he would always say at the end of the song, Steve, turn around and just walk upstage, and I'll pull the camera back and we'll fade. And I was so used to, singing in a nightclub or in a theater. I said, can I take a bow to the audience at the end of the show? He says, come on, Stevie, we've had this conversation. This is television. You're not, it's not a saloon. It's not a nightclub. You're doing something. He says, so I love you, so I'll pull back. You turn around and fade to black and start to walk upstage. So and it really bothered me, as a performer, that I didn't acknowledge the applause at the end of the song. So after doing this for a couple of years, I said to him, Dwight, you created a very strange happening in my life. He said, what's that? I said, well, when I walk in the street, people don't recognize me till I pass them. When I walk past them and they see me walking by, I say, hey, aren't you on
was it passing them, or was it like, somebody would look at you and go, I think I know you, but could I put a pie in your face to make sure?
Yeah. Yeah, it's nice to see you back. Yeah, it was just... But it was a great time in television when it was live. Mistakes that were made, to this day, people say, I saw the show the night that this happened and that happened. Now you have the luxury of tape, and if somebody makes a mistake, you go back and do it again. But I tell you, there was something very terrific about making an honest mistake, or... Edie and I both individually and collectively, we knew 1,000 different songs, So, but there were some that, we weren't quite sure of because they were lengthy songs, like a long song like Begin the Begin or something like that. So they would use cue cards on the side, and I would occasionally refer to it if I wasn't sure, And everybody was a comic on the show. Everybody was a clown. Nick Vanoff, who started out on our show, he became later a very successful producer. But Nicky held cue cards on the show, and he'd flip the cards when they begin. The beginner brings back the night of music's attender. The second card would be in French. The third card was in Hebrew. The fourth card was in Italian. So I was having to fight for my life, and I always said to this day, Cole Porter doesn't know how many songs I wrote with him.
But when you were doing the early televisions with Steve Allen, and I've seen the stuff that you did with Carol Burnett on her show with you and Edie, and there's something that I think is the magic, especially of the two of you together, and in as solos, is that there's a certain amount of humor that you have been able to do. Because when, I've heard the people say, Steve and Edie are Hollywood's happiest couple. And that comes across in screen either when you're performing together or on solo, and you're performing in comedy, because both of you do have very good timing when it comes to comedy. Then that must have been something that you learned with Steve Allen.
Well, Steve has a great deal to do with that, because every night, we were on Monday to Friday. Originally, the program was 1 hour and 45 minutes long. We went on at 11:15. In those days, it was only 15 minutes worth of news. Today, they're on 24/7. You know, so the news went on from 11 to 11:15. We went on from 11:15 to 1 o'clock in the morning. And Steve is open and says, "Well, I'm sure there's nobody watching out there, so it doesn't matter. So I'll just take a nap and just, you know, whatever it was." You know. But before I joined the Steve Allen Show, and I had a record or two out on King Records, and I started to get some offers for employment to work in nightclubs, and I was the opening act for so many different comedians, and I just admired the guts that these guys had to get up there alone by themselves, no music helping them. And just get out there and say, you know, a funny thing happened to me on the way to the club tonight. And they'd have to be funny for a half hour or 40 minutes or whatever they were doing, you know. So my regard for the guy who gets up in one and has to be funny, and the guys who do it very well, I had the pleasure of opening for so many of them, from Milton Berle down to whomever, or up to Sideways, whoever. I worked with all of them, and that was a great training for me, too. I used to sit and watch them in the wings all the time and how they reacted to an audience, their timing. And Steve Allen, of course, was the greatest show because I was there every night. And it was fun to go. You know, it was a live show. We went on, as I said, 11:15 at night. So we didn't have to come in to, like, 4 or 5 o'clock in the afternoon and just fake a song that we were going to do that night, because we had no money for arrangements. The show didn't have a budget for that. So we would just pick our keys and do it, and the guys would fake and comp, you know, just make an ending at the end of the song. So, but we used to come in like, you know, like 11, 12 o'clock and just hang around. And just everybody had such laughs and such good times. It was such friendships, you know, developed on that show. And I just... As a matter of fact, as I'm talking to you now, Keith, I'm looking at a baby picture of Steve Allen on my office wall. Years ago, I started collecting baby pictures of friends of mine in the business. And Steve Allen, I have Steve Allen's baby picture. There's so many friends of mine in the business. But Steve, you look at him and say, yeah, that was him.
Does he have the glasses?
No glasses. If he did, he wasn't wearing them. But he's wearing a cute little collar, and it looked like a little photo, not photo, but a cute little white collar, and it was a black and white picture, of course, in those days. It was like, I guess it was a gray shirt. It could have been a color, but it looks gray.
You're walking along the street, or you're at a party, or else you're alone, and then you suddenly dig. You're looking in someone's eyes, you suddenly realize that this could be the start of something big. You're lunching at 21 and watching your diet, declining a Charlotte Russe, accepting a fig. When out of the clear blue sky, it suddenly gets start of something big. There's no controlling the unrolling of your fate, my friend. Who knows what's written in a magic book?
But when a lover you discover at the gate, my friend, invite her in without a second look.
You're up in an aeroplane, or dining at Sardi's, or lying at Malibu alone on the sand. You suddenly hear a bell, and right away you can tell that this could be the start of something grand.
This could be the start of something very big. Why don't you play your part? Please give your heart to me and see. This could be the start of something wonderful. Why don't you take a chance? Just try romance with me and see.
You're watching the sun come up, counting your money,
girl.
Or else in a dim cafe, you're ordering wine. Then suddenly there he is, and you want to be where.
This must be the start of something. This could be the heart of something. This could be the
start of something big.
This could be the start of something big, Steve Lawrence and Edie Gourmet. And if you've just tuned in, you're listening to a very special edition of the Happy Station Show with my special guest, Steve Lawrence. If you would like to get in touch with us to let us know what you think of the program or request or anything, you can find out all our contact information at our website at www.pcjmedia.com. That's www.pcjmedia.com. Now back to our exclusive interview with Steve Lawrence. You and Edie have also recorded together. When the two of you are working together in the studio, do you have, like, the husband and wife spats in the studio as well, going, and she's saying to you, Steve, no, I'm not doing this.
I think by the time we get to the studio, we've worked with the material, and I think we pretty much are set in what we're going to do. We've had the discussions, whether they were mild or heated, we had that while we were living with the material or at home or wherever. But, I mean, we've had, look, we're normal people. Husbands, we've had husband and wife fights that were beauties, you know. I mean, like anybody else, you know. It's, Edie and I will be married 51 years next, at the end of December. That is our 52nd anniversary. So over those many years, you've had to have had a couple of disagreements, a couple of fights. One of the best shows we did, a live show, we had a fight in the dressing room, a real husband and wife fight. And we just were foaming at the mouth at each other. And you just can't turn that off. And we were screaming at each other. What do you mean you're debating? And the guy says, now, ladies and gentlemen, here are the stars of our show. Steve Lawrence, Edie Gourmet. We walked out with such venom at looking at each other. And we were such, I said everything to her that any husband ever wanted to say to his wife. And Edie said everything that every wife wanted to say to her husband. In between songs, we didn't let it end. We were just, it was like therapy. We were taking it out on this poor audience who came here to have a good time. And the more neurotic and heated we got, they thought it was part of the act. They were laughing like you can't believe. Keith, they thought it was, I swear to you, they thought this was written stuff and that Mel Brooks wrote it or something. I don't know. But and at the end of an hour, we were like washed, like, you know, like we got off the couch like at a psychiatrist. So at the end of an hour we did on stage, we were fine, and we left all our problems with that audience who thought it was part of the act. They had a terrific time. And then every once in a while, we would run into somebody who said, I was there in Chicago that night that you had that fight with Edie, and I remember what you said. It was incredible. Absolutely incredible. You can't turn that on and off at will, you know.
It was probably one of those moments that even if you had the best writers in the world, they probably never would have been able to create anyway.
Now, as a matter of fact, when we started to work together, we knew all the writers, you know, the guys who wrote on Steve Allen's show, and I even got to Neil Simon and Mel Brooks, who I knew, and Larry Gelbart, and all these guys who said, hey, we want to do an act. Can you guys write for us? So they came to see us, and they said, hey, you guys do naturally. We can't write what the hell you guys do. You know, you guys are doing husband and wife lines back and forth. We can't write that stuff, you know. So Mel Brooks, of course, was the craziest one of them all. He says, I'll tell you what you do. You and Edie come out on a motorcycle, and your guy says, no, you're crazy. He says, of course. Why do you think I'm here? Yeah. So they never really wrote anything for us, and our act evolved over a period of years, you know. And we managed to, stuff that worked for us, we managed to recreate, change the words, but recreate it. And by letting it loose, we'd always find new things to talk about, new things to do. Somebody once said, who writes your act? I said, nobody. I said, Edie, how you feel? And she talks for an hour. You know.
When the two of you met, was it love at first sight, or was it something that evolved when you were doing the television show?
Well, she often has said it was love at first sight for her. And me, it has always taken me a little while to recognize a great thing. But no, I did care for her. There was sparks early on, and we went together for 4 or 5 years before we married. And so we, you know, it was quite an experience. I always run into people who said, you know, I watched your two kids when you were young on the Tonight Show. I always knew you were going to marry that girl. So I would always say, well, why don't you tell me? You could have saved me a lot of time and a lot of money. But, yeah, we kind of felt something, there was something there when we met. And I knew when I was in Brooklyn and she was in the Bronx, so I knew when I was driving her home, I knew I cared for her. That's a long drive.
You know, you're going to be married 51 years at the end of December.
52.
52 years at the end of December. I mean, not just in Hollywood, but even in New York, especially in the field of entertainment. I mean, this is something which is extremely rare.
I think today it's rare to have a friend for that long. It really is. But I think we're blessed on a lot of different levels. Edie and I, aside from a love that we share, and we're great friends. She's my best critic, and I'm her best critic. We understand each other inside out.
Mm-hmm.
We both have a great understanding for what it is we do, because we both do the same thing. I mean, I don't have to come home, and she says, well, how was your day at the office? Because she was there too, you know. So I don't have to explain the other side of my life to her, because she's both sides of my life, you know. She is my best audience. God, she laughs at everything I do.
You know, when the two of you would record albums individually, how honest were you with each other? I mean, there must have been times where she would look at you after you released an album saying, Steve, why did you do this? And you would look at her saying, what is this? Has that ever happened already?
those are exactly the words, Keith. I mean, if I was at a record, before we started, getting actively involved in producing our own records, I said, where did you find that piece of junk? Who found that for you? Said, well, this and that. And if it was an arranger other than Don Costa or Nick Burrito or Billy May or Nelson Riddle or Billy Byers or Alan Ferg, guys that we worked with who were extraordinarily gifted, you know, the company found an arranger and said, where the hell did you find this guy? You know.
Mm-hmm.
So there were a lot of things that we both looked at each other askance and how did you, you know, hey, look, we all make mistakes. And like I said earlier, there's a lot of them we'd like to swallow and just take them back.
Mm-hmm. Now, you worked with Don Costa for many, many years. Is he almost associated with the Steve and Edie duo as much as Steve and Edie themselves? Would you say that?
Yes.
Yes.
Yes. Don Costa was the other piece of our troika. He was he was an extension of both of us, and such a huge contributor to the success of our musical careers on records, and even things that he wrote for us in person to do, musical arrangements, you know. He was a great friend, and he possessed genius. I mean, he's a guy that this was an instinctive, I mentioned before about songwriters who were bright, educated, and knew the language and how to put it together. And then there was the instinct guy. Don was all music from head to toe, all instinct. And people would look at him and say, how does he hear this? You know, he was not schooled and trained like those guys who graduated Juilliard or whatever the school was. He heard this in his head. And these guys, it's a gift. If all these guys were living in the 18th and 17th century, they would have been the classical composers of their day.
Mm-hmm.
They would have been Brahms, Beethoven, and Mozart. These guys like Costa and Riddle and Billy May and Purito, all these guys. They would have been the Brahms and Beethoven and Schumann and Chopin. And it's incredible what they heard. And they would look at an empty score pad, and they could hear what they were writing in their heads. They were writing for like four trumpets and four trombones and four French horns and violins and violas and cellos. They heard it in their head. What a gift. My God, it's incredible. And I just I admire them, the good ones, so much so. There's not enough I can say about the great contribution that they've made in our careers musically, and the friendship which we had, great friendships. And unfortunately, these guys are just they're not making them anymore. You know, There's a couple of people that are still around.
You know, in the last number of years, we've seen some singers come along that are quite young. I mean, I can think of, let's say, you know, Harry Connick Jr. or Diana Krall, or even, you know, most recently in the last few years, Michael Bublé, who've come along and are singing the American Songbook. When you look at this new generation of singers and the fact that they are being very successful with it commercially, do you think that this may in some way, you know, over the next while, you know, influence the large corporations that are running it and say, you know what, there's still money to be made with the American Songbook and this style of music?
I would hope so. I couldn't agree with you more. And I'm astonished that like Diana Krall and Harry Connick Jr., Michael Bublé, that they made it as big as they did in this world of music that we're living in now. So it seems that there is an audience out there, and they can be reached. But I think they probably want to be reached by the younger people that they can relate to on the calendar.
Mm-hmm.
So, and I understand that as well, you know. But the point is, I think on a record, you don't know how old that person is or who it is. So I think that we're missing a lot of wonderful artists that are not recording today. You know, when you stop to think that if all those people that we grew up singing their praises, and, you know, Frank Sinatra, Ella Fitzgerald, Perry Como, Buddy Clark, Dick Haymes, Sarah Vaughan, these people couldn't get a record contract today for love of money.
Mm-hmm. But yet,
and it is a shame. It is a shame, but it's the truth.
But yet, what is interesting is that their material is still being released today, and it's still being sold. I mean, Ella Fitzgerald and Frank Sinatra, their catalogs are being released. Yeah,
their catalogs are being sold, and people are going to Amazon and picking it up. Yeah, and they're repackaging them and boxing them, and they digitalize them. And you know, the technology today, that they try to make them sound even, you know, brighter, like they were more recently recorded, you know.
Mm-hmm.
So I think there is a market out there, and but it's a narrower market than it's ever been. You know, everything is so it's pop rock, it's pop rock gen, there's country pop and country rock, country pop. You know, everything's got like. You become, there's so many pigeonholes up there that I don't know what some the alternative rock. What's alternative about it? I mean, you either like it or not. So I don't know if I were coming up today, I would probably have to become a plumber.
On a wonderful day like today, I defy any cloud to appear in the sky, dare any raindrop to plop in my eye. On a wonderful day like today, on a wonderful evening like this, when the moon is as big as a yellow balloon, even the crickets are singing in tune. On a wonderful evening like this, on an evening like this, I could kiss everybody. I'm so full of love and goodwill. May I say furthermore, I'd adore everybody to come and dine. The pleasure's mine and I will pay the bill. May I take this occasion to say that the whole human race should fall down on its knees, show that we're grateful for mornings like these, for the world's in a wonderful way. On a wonderful day like today, today, I could kiss everybody. I'm so full of love and goodwill. Today, I'd adore everybody to come and dine. The pleasure is mine, and I will pay the bill. May I take this occasion to say
that the whole human race should fall down on its knees. Show that we're grateful for mornings like these, for the world's in a wonderful way, on a wonderful day, on a beautiful day, on a wonderful, wonderful day, like today.
And that was our tribute to Steve Lawrence and Edie Gourmet. In particular, Edie Gourmet, who passed away last week at age 84. Well, guess what? We're now out of time. If you wish to contact us to let us know what you think of the program, our email address is hs@pcjmedia.com. That's hs@pcjmedia.com. Happy Station Show will be returning to the regular PCJ International scheduled show we broadcast on September the 1st at 1330 UTC on 11835 kHz, targeting listeners in Southeast and East Asia. You can find our details at our website, www.pcjmedia.com. I think that for today's program, it would be best if we end with another song from Edie Gourmet. The song is called If He Walked Into My Life. Edie will always remember you. So until next time, friends, so long, au revoir, auf Wiedersehen, adios amigos, and sayonara.
Did he need a stronger hand? Did he need touch? Was I soft or was I tough? Did I give enough? Did I give too much? At the moment that he needed me, did I ever turn away? Would I be there when he called? If he walked into my life today, were his days a little dull? Were his nights a little wild? Did I overstate my plan? Did I stress the man and forget the child? And there must have been a million things that my heart forgot to say. Would I think of one or two if he walked into my life today? Would I blame the times I pampered him, or blame the times I bossed him? What a shame I never really found the boy before I lost him. Were the years a little fast? Was his world a little free? Was there too much of a crowd, all too lush and loud, and not enough of me? Then ask myself my whole life long, what went wrong along the way? Would I make the same mistakes If he walked into my life,